You're listening to the Victory Podcast. We hope this message will find favor in your life. For more updates about Victory, log on to victory.org.ph and bookmark our website in your browser. Now, here's your message.
Now, I haven't seen any of the X-Men. I haven't watched any. I'm not sure who they are. But I'm more concerned about the next men, okay? The next generation. But I did watch Pirates. I really appreciate, this has nothing to do with the sermon, I really appreciate for once, Hollywood never does this, but they did. They presented the missionary as a heroic, non-effeminate, non-weird person. I thought, what happened to Hollywood? The missionary actually is a functional person. Usually they make the missionary, the pastor, the preacher, some kind of wacko. But anyway, now he did fall for the fish thing, yeah. But besides that, all right, since we're talking about movies, I really thank you for the privilege of being here. And I want to say this to all of you. I'm very grateful for the leadership of your pastors in this movement. And when we talk about Next Generation in a moment, I'll talk a little bit about the origins of this church and how we started. And one of your pastors has been one of the very originals, goes all the way back. Carbon dating has proven all the way back to the original, one of the first meetings we ever had. That's Pastor, soon to be Dr. Winston Reyes, is one of the absolute originals and has had, I think, every role anybody on staff could ever have except kids pastor. You've never been a kids pastor, right? And he's never been in charge of women's ministry. Besides that, I think Winston's done every other role you could do and be on staff. And I really am grateful for the leadership that he's provided all of these 27 years of this ministry. He's been a part the whole 27 years. So Winston, thank you for all you do. And also Pastor Mark, some of us were at the Ignite conference, our student conference, 7,000 young people and a few old people. How many were at Ignite? All right. When I looked at that, all those people, I thought back to, it wasn't just the current Ignite team, Joe Bonifacio and your leader here, Dan, and some of these, it wasn't that. They did a great job, but they built on the foundation laid by a lot of the foundation laid by your pastor, Mark. He was our national director of the campus ministries for years, traveling in the provinces and doing so much work to reach our campuses in this nation. And before that, he was the pastor of our U-Belt church, which is at the heartbeat of all the student activity here in the Philippines. And Joe and our leadership team at Ignite acknowledged that the work that Mark and others that have been involved in campus ministry, all the 27 years of our ministry, a lot of the honor and the gratitude is due to them. And I just want to recognize that. Mark, thank you for all of your work, not just in the campus, but for in this ministry. You and Rizelle, thank you for your leadership and all that you guys do. I preached this morning at our congregation at Victory Fort at 8 and 10. And after that, we had a long lunch with some of the pastors there. And then I was laying down to rest before coming here, and I text Pastor Mark and I said, no need to pick me up, I'll drive myself, see you at 4. I was coming to do the 4 and the 6 o'clock services. And then my phone rang and he said, we don't have a 4 or a 6, it's 3 and 5. So I got up real quick and had to rush here, and it took as long to park as it did to drive from the fort to here. So from the fort to here was 15 minutes. From the bottom of the parking to the parking was another 15 minutes. And then I parked. Fortunately, I have a little Suzuki car. It's a little bigger. It's like a little Suzuki car. So I parked on the sidewalk, and I'm not in a parking place. It's no other cars but a Suzuki could fit there. And if it's in anybody's way, they can kind of just pick it up and move it over. So the advantage of having little Japanese cars. Anyway, thank you for braving the traffic and the crowds. What we want to share today, as you see, this will be every year in Victory. We take a moment, or we take a week, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks some years, and some of the things we preach, we repeat each year. At Christmas time, it's always important to talk about the incarnation. At Easter time, it's always important to remind ourselves about the cross and the resurrection. There are a few other topics we preach every year in Victory, and others we might not preach for once every 10 years. But this is one that every year we have at least 1 week, maybe 2 weeks, where we talk about the next generation, where we talk about the importance that we see as a church community and as a movement of people, the important place and the role of young people and the next generation. And that has led over the 27 years history of this church, periodically throughout history of our history. Sometimes people who maybe they're new at the church and they don't really understand why we do some of the things we do, sometimes they'll say, you know, it seems like maybe at Victory there's too much emphasis on the youth, and maybe we're a little overboard about, you know, campus, you know, high schools. It's just maybe a little too much. And I think it's a valid question. I think it's a valid thing to address is, do we overemphasize youth and kids in high school ministry and university ministry? Do we overemphasize it? Do we put too much into that? I think to answer that question, I think we have to understand a little bit about this country. And I want to show you some graphics in a moment. But when I was in university, I was a business management major, and my most dreaded class was statistics. I hated statistics. The only class worse than statistics was statistics 2. And you know the one class worse than statistics 2? Managerial accounting. But statistics were horrible. But let me try to explain something from our statistics class. And it is the idea of the median age in a country. Not medium, like small, medium, large. But median, within it, median. It's not an average. It's not the average age. And I want to talk about the median age in the Philippines for us to understand, do we overemphasize youth? Or maybe could we possibly even underemphasize youth in this church? The median age. Median is this. The way you understand median, it's if you get an average, you add up all the ages divided by the number of people, there's an average. But median is a bit different. Median, you take the center point, okay? So what is the one? And there's just as many on this side and that side, right in the middle, okay? So the median age means there's equal number that are younger and older. So, for instance, in the UK, my oldest son studies in the UK. And in where he lives, the median age in the UK is 40. What that means is if you add up everybody who's from 40 to 50, from 50 to 60, everybody in their 70s, 80s, 90s, 100 and older, add up all those people, and then you add up everybody who's under 40 in their 30s, 20s, teens, preteens, you add up all those, and it's the same amount. Got it? In the U.S., the median age is 38. Okay, and what do we have next? In Iran, the median age is 26. And you'll find that most Muslim countries, the median age is lower because they have larger families. And most prosperous Western countries, you know, the wealthier nations are, they figure they can't afford kids. So they have less smaller families, but the poorer nations can afford them. Figure that. Egypt, the median age is 24. And the Philippines, where we are right now, the median age is 22. Here's what that means. First of all, how many of you are less than 22? Raise your hand. How many of you are over 22? Here's what this means. If you're over 22, you are older than half of the country. Who's 23 here? Welcome to old age. You're older than half of your country. You don't look that old, but you are. What does that mean for me and Winston? We are antique. We're beyond old. Now, here's what this means. the median age of 22. If you take everybody who's less than 22, which means if they're 21, 20, teenagers and preteens. So if they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20, or 21, those people. That's the same number of people, Filipinos, as everybody who's in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 100 plus. You add up every Filipino who's 30, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way up, add all those up, and it's the same as those who are less than 22. Got it? So I ask you, do we overemphasize youth in this church? The question is this: when will the church embrace that reality that this is a young nation? Everybody but the church recognizes that. You go to McDonald's, and you know what? One third of their store is dedicated not to more seating space, not to more kitchen capacity, but to a children's playground, because they care to make money from the young people. MTV, you think they're targeting you? You people who are over 22, you think they care about you? No. Somebody said MTV's targeting the 14-year-olds. MTV said, no, we don't target 14-year-olds. We own 14-year-olds. That's sad. That's scary. Apple Computers, you know, the maker of the iPod, iPad, iPhone, iMac. And when you know what? When you have all those, you know what you are? I broke. Apple Computers has always have special discounts for university students because they value the money of the young people. The question is, the whole world recognizes this, but the church acts as if youth is a side issue in the church. So the question is, do we overemphasize? If our church, the question is, will we recognize that? And secondly, will we ever reflect that? If 50% of the people who live on these 7,000 Philippine islands, if 50% of them are under 22 years old, shouldn't our church reflect that? If our church is more than half the people are 30 and 40 years old, we're not reflecting. Now, if you're 30 and 40, we're really glad you're here. But you know what? I wish we reflected the culture and the nation. So I would say, I don't think we overemphasize youth. I think we underemphasize it. And if that bothers you, forget the idea of youth. Just take that word out. Don't even talk about that. How many of you believe our church should reach the Philippines? How many of you like that? We should reach the Philippines. Then you know what it means? Half of the people we're supposed to reach are less than 22. So that should be reflected in the church. If we're going to reach this nation, we will have to pay attention to youth. Now, I have three sons, my wife and I. They're all adults. They're grown adult sons. 21-year-old, 23-year-old, 25-year-old. They all were born in Makati Med. They all went to elementary school and high school in Antipolo. They all grew up here. They consider this home. This is the only home they knew. My oldest son, all of my kids, my oldest son is studying in the UK, getting his master's. My middle son just graduated from a university in the States, and my youngest son keeps on begging us to let him drop out because he has about three businesses he started. He's wasting time in school because he's got these businesses he's building. So we're forcing him, torturing, child abuse, making him go to college. But anyway, he's always got another deal, how he can, if this deal goes through, will you let me quit school so I can do this full time? You make me a 51% partner, I'll think about it. But my oldest son, having grown up here, when he went to the university in America, he got a tennis scholarship, and he went there. The coach was interviewing him. He was showing him around. And when he got there, everybody referred to him on the tennis team, this is the guy from the Philippines. When he was here, all his Filipino friends said, this is my American friend.
So he's got a huge identity crisis. Okay, in America, he's the guy from the Philippines. Here, he's the American guy. So he lives in the UK. Completely logical. And he feels called to France. He lived in France last year. So when he finishes his master's, he wants to go. He feels like God's called him to France. So anyway, I'm really thankful. My wife and I talk about it a lot, how grateful we are that God allowed our kids to grow up in this city and this culture. We're thankful. We really are. We couldn't think of a better place. I wouldn't change a thing about how we were able to raise our kids here. Very grateful. I find a lot of Filipinos who think, if I could only migrate to America or Canada or Dubai or Australia or wherever, then life would be good. No, no, no. You're missing what you have right in front of you. Then other people think, you know, if I could, maybe I can't migrate, but maybe I can go get a job and make dollars or dirhams and send them back, and then life would be great. You know what? It'd probably be better if you just stayed and raised your family. They need you more than they need your money. Just a side note there. Now, and it all has to do with how we see what's in front of us. My sons are here for 2 weeks with us on this trip, and my two younger ones, the 23-year-old and the 21-year-old, and they went down to the U-Belt with a friend a couple of days ago. They had not been to the U-Belt in several years. They came back talking about how different it was and how things had changed since they had been there. And my wife and I were talking about that, how different things were when we first came to the Philippines 27 years ago, 1984. And we went to the U-Belt. And as I mentioned, Pastor Winston, he wasn't Pastor Winston, he wasn't Dr. Winston, he was just Winston, was one of the originals we met down there. And he was from a Christian home and came to the church and was one of the first leaders in our church. And we thought about all how different things were in those days. And if we're going to reach this nation, which is mostly young people, we have to understand who they are, who this nation. I don't mean the old people who are 23 and older. I mean the young people. Okay? You people in your mid-20s, you're the old ones, remember. When we would go down there, when I first was going down to the U-Belt in 84, the big high-tech entertainment, students would be in our student center playing sunka. Okay? That was the high-tech game. Okay? High-tech. Chess was even more high-tech. This required little thinking. And then when we got tired of that, we would go out and play street games. And the most demanding and most competitive street game was Patintero. Remember that? Now, how many of you have never played that? Anybody never played that? Come on, honestly, come on. All right, everybody has. Okay, some of your... Remember Robert Hearn, Pastor Robert Hearn from Victory Pioneer? Yep. He's like, well, if there was ever an Olympic team, he would be like the Michael Jordan. Because he had this, like, the wingspan of a 7-footer. Pastor, it just wasn't fair. His arms are like, 2 of my arms are 1 of his. He was amazing. But, you know, in those days, U-Belt, we would play parlor games, board games, and street games like this. But then the world changed in the mid-80s. And it was no more parlor games and street games. It became screen games. And what changed the world? You know who changed the world? Pac-Man. That's right. No. Not Congressman Emmanuel Pacquiao. Not him. Pac-Man, that little Japanese tennis ball with a mouth that 8 dots. How many of you have never played Pac-Man? Raise your hand. Come on, never. Some of you don't even know what it is. That means you've never played it. Also, all the old people, 23 and over, have... Pac-Man became this video game, and people would, they didn't do parlor games and board games. They didn't do street games anymore. Now it was these in front of a screen, putting their coins in, but then the coins would run out, and then you go back and play, you know, basketball with a, you know, in a coat hanger. Now that led to other things, spin-offs, Donkey Kong and other things like that. And eventually, it led to very addictive screen games like Dota. Okay? Now, I know everybody from the last service is across the hall playing Dota right now. And some people will get hypnotized by the Dota screen and will miss meals fast and go sometimes not hours but days like this. But it went beyond addiction now. As things have changed because people get addicted to their screens, now it's not just Dota. Now it's not just an addiction to a game like that. Now it's a lifestyle. And even beyond a lifestyle, it's life support. And life itself is done through, first it was, I think it was Friendster, then Multiply, then MySpace, then MyFace, and then Facebook and SpaceFace and all those spinoffs. All those things where we're always, so much so that now this generation, the young people, not the old ones, not 22 and over. How many of you are 23, 24? Not you old people. Okay, the young ones, 22 and under, have been called, they're no longer called teenagers. They're called screenagers. Yeah, screenagers. You know why? Because they live their lives in front of four screens. They always have a screen, and they do life through screens. And while parlor games and board games and street games were merely entertainment, the screen generation, the screenagers, it's not just entertainment. It's relationships, but it's also something that shapes values and shapes beliefs and shapes the core of who they are. For better and for worse, there are some good things about it and there are some bad things about it. And the four screens that screenagers always live with, there's a telephone, that's a screen we're always looking at. Where's my phone? Winston, don't make any overseas calls. That is a screen. We're always looking at the telephone screen. There's the computer screen. There's the telephone, the computer screen. There's the television screen and there's the movie screen. And sometimes my sons are doing all three at the same time. Three of the four. And I go, wait, you only have two eyes. How are you doing three screens at once? Dad, you don't get it. But two of my sons are the old guys now. They're 23 and 25, at least compared to the Philippines. They're still young in America. The screenagers. There was a recent study done, a survey question. They asked 16-year-olds, a group of 16-year-olds to 24-year-olds. Here's the question. What is your preferred method of communication? Here's the results. Number one, text messaging. Number two, internet, really primarily Facebook to communicate. Number three, podcast. Number four, instant messaging. Number five, cell phone. Number six, DVD. Number seven, books. Wow, books made out of dead trees. Books, paper. They actually acknowledge that. Number seven. And number eight, email. One of the guys in the survey said this. Yes, email is a good way to communicate with old people. Old people. Some of you thought, I thought it was pretty cool. I'm sending emails. Observation of that list of communication methods. It goes from the most personal to the least personal. Text messages on a phone are very personal. Nobody has your number except people who got it from you. People that you don't know don't send you a text message. It's personal and it's immediate. And this generation, they want it very relational and very personal and very instant. Now, what does all that mean for us? Reaching these screenagers, all of these people who are under 22, this nation, what does it mean? We want to look at a scripture today and next week that'll talk about what we're supposed to do and how we can do this. Whether you're a parent, a grandparent, or whether you're a single person and you never intend to be a parent, there's something about this next generation. And I think the word speaks to us in Hebrews 11. We want to look for a few moments at the life of Moses. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 through 27. And I want you to notice one word that shows up in verse 23 and verse 27. Today we'll focus on verse 23. Next week we'll focus on verse 27, but it's the same words. And it's the word saw, S-A-W. Notice what they saw in verse 23 and verse 27. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they, here it is, they saw he was no ordinary child. And they were not afraid of the king's edict. Verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. 26, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. Verse 27, here's the ending. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because what? He saw him who is invisible. So today we want to look at what is it important for us to see. What do you see when you look at the next generation? Next week we'll talk about what the next generation needs to see. Or really, who the next generation needs to see. Because Moses saw someone. And by seeing someone, he was able to make the right choices and able to navigate through life in a way that honored God. But today, it's the previous generation. What do we see? That's the key part. Now, Moses, let me give a little background. Moses was one of the greatest, most amazing leaders ever in the Bible. I mean, the guy did miracles, created bugs and turned the Nile River into blood and called down hail storms and dust storms and turned a microphone stand into a snake. There was actually a stick like this and dropped it. The guy was amazing. He went up on the mountain face to face with God and got the Ten Commandments, which is the foundation of all social order throughout the civilized world for the last, 3,000 years. What a man. He took a group of slaves and brought them to freedom in the promised land. And not only that, but somehow got the Egyptians to load them down with gold. And he started a new nation and he prepared these people to go into the promised land. Moses, wow, what a man. But it started way before that. If you remember why the Hebrew people were in Egypt in the first place. Anybody remember why? Joseph. Remember Joseph? Great, 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 great to the 10th power grandfather of Moses or something like that. Maybe not that long. Joseph comes there because of a series of dreams and his brothers messing with his life and God's providential hand moving him there. And then Joseph ends up sort of in charge of Egypt, the guy who's ethnically different, religiously different, but God made a way for him and now he's in charge and his family comes. They start multiplying. A few generations go by. There's more Hebrews, a few more generations. There's more. And now the new king of Egypt, this new Pharaoh, looks around and goes, there's too many Hebrews here. Egyptians don't like Hebrews. There's racial tension. And so he decides, let's enslave them. Let's turn them into slaves. And then he decides that's not enough. So he says, let's kill all the firstborn. Not the firstborn. Let's just kill all the baby boys so we can get rid of these people. So he makes a law that whenever a Hebrew male is born, they're supposed to dunk them in the river and drown them. That's the law. And so these Hebrew midwives, the Bible says in Exodus, they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh, so they refused to abort or kill the new babies, and they preserved them. In comes Moses' parents. It's interesting that in Hebrews, Moses' parents remain nameless. In the Old Testament, their names are mentioned, but in the New Testament, they don't mention their names. And they come up, and their baby boy is born, and they know the law is we're supposed to kill him. We can't raise a Hebrew child. But again, they fear God, not Pharaoh. So they make a little boat, a little ark, put Moses in a little basket. And they push the basket in the river. They hid him for 3 months. And now they realize they can't hide him anymore. They put him in the river and push him over to where Pharaoh's daughter is having her little swimming party. And she takes him. Remember, she takes him out of the river. And she goes, wow, this must be a Hebrew baby. And Moses' sister's kind of wandering around there. And she says, hey, would you go find one of the Hebrew ladies to be the yaya for this baby? And so she goes back and gets Moses' mother to get hired as the Yaya, the only person in the Bible who was paid to be a mother. Some of you are going, wow, I wish someone would pay me. And so Moses grows up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, but he grows up ethnically, racially different, but really being raised by his mother, whom everyone thought was the Yaya. Now, so going, you know, you imagine he's growing up. He's a teenager. Is this your mom, Moses? You don't look the same. You look as different as Mark and I. Is this, are you related? Well, yeah, this is my mom. You know, you kind of look more like your Yaya. Well, this is my Yaya, but sort of my mom. And she's your mom? Well, sort of my mom. She got me out of the river. And is that your dad? Well, I don't. That's a different question. I have no idea who my dad is. I don't know where he is because Pharaoh's daughter, I'm not sure she had a husband. So is Pharaoh your grandfather? Well, sort of. People like that today end up in therapy. But not him, because in those days they learned to see the providential hand of God working in their lives. And anybody in therapy trying to figure out who they are, you probably do better to try to find the providential hand of God that orchestrated your life to end up the way it ended up. Because you could find the hand of God, then you'll find healing and you'll find wholeness and you'll find purpose. But if you can choose to remain a victim for all of your life and just end up, you know, doing that thing, then that's really not the best way to go. So anyway, here he goes. He's born. His parents look at him and they think, wow, we can't kill him. We can't throw him to the culture and do what the world expects us to do. We've got to do it differently. And I hope you parents hear that. I hope you parents look at your children and go, we can't just do this like everybody else does. We can't just do what the culture expects us to do with our kids. We have a higher allegiance and a better way, and we better figure out what God wants us to do with our kids. And if you raise your kids differently than everybody else does out there, and you do it unto God, then don't worry about it. Hopefully you will do it different, and not just what the culture and the world and the pharaohs out there expect you to do. So they did it differently. Now, turns out pretty amazing. Moses is an amazing guy. And it says in the passage we read that Moses refused to hold to the things of Egypt. He refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And then the next verse says, and he chose rather suffering with the people of God. I dream of a generation of Filipinos rising up that will know how to refuse the things of Pharaoh in Egypt and choose the things of God. That will know how to refuse the sin for a moment of pleasure and choose to carry a cross and serve God. A generation that will refuse the lure of wealth and all the stuff out there that really doesn't matter and will choose the purpose and the way of God. How do you raise a generation like that? How do we raise people, young people who grow up knowing what to refuse and what to choose? How do you do it? Look in this passage, it gives us a simple solution to this. Three things. Number one, if you're going to raise up a Moses generation, number one, vision. Vision is required. Here's what it says. Verse 23, his parents saw that he was no ordinary child. Vision, sight. What do you see? How do you see the next generation? Do you see that all the problems? Do you see all the pitfalls? Do you see, oh, they're just a lazy generation. They don't have any. Well, how do you see it? Or do you, like Moses' parents, see the potential? I heard the story of a shoe company. It was expanding into new areas. They sent two salesmen out, and they ended up in this tropical island. And one salesman looked at all the people and he sent back a message to headquarters and it said, everyone barefoot, no market. The other salesman looked at these people and he said, sent back this message to headquarters, everyone barefoot, no competition, sales potential unlimited. How do you see the next generation? Do you see the problem and the obstacles, or do you see the potential in God's hand? I have a good friend who's in our church, Victory Pioneer. He sees things differently than a lot of people. He's a collector of old cars, Jaguars in particular, 40s and 50s, cars made in the 40s and 50s. And he's found many of them in different places in the Philippines. And usually they're out in some provincial field and they're rusted out. No wheels, no windshield, no motor, with grass and trees growing out of them. You know the scene? You know what I'm talking about? And he sees something beyond that. I've seen some of these piles of junk, and I'm going, Sito, why would you buy that and drag it to your garage? Why? Next picture, here's why. Because this is what he sees in those Jaguars. That's one of those Jaguars that you and I would see a pile of junk, and he saw that. Never mind Rico and Kitty. That was their wedding car. It's Pastor Rico from Ortigas. He borrowed Sito's Jaguar for his wedding car. But he saw that. I saw a rusted out pile of junk. Sito saw something else. With a little work, with a little restoration, with a lot of money, with what? But look what it could become. I hope you'll see the next generation that way. I hope you'll see your own children that way. Oh, sure, there's some rust. Sure, there's some stuff that needs to be replaced. But boy, with restoration, with a little work and a lot of money and a little time, look what could happen. Look what it could be. You've got to see vision. I am so thankful that I grew up in a family where my parents, I think like Moses' parents, they saw something special in all five of their children. I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I didn't grow up in a religious home. But I grew up with parents who saw greatness in their kids. I grew up around, this is the kind of home I grew up in. From the time I was little until my parents passed away a few years ago. No matter what I did, same with all my siblings, no matter what we did. Oh, Dad, oh, you want to be a basketball player? You'll probably be the best there's ever been. That was just the attitude. Oh, you want to be a businessman? You'll probably be the best businessman ever. You want to be a brain surgeon? You'll probably be the best ever. Now, there was a level of unreality we grew up with. But we grew up having our parents as our greatest fans. You could do it. And somebody asked me the other day, is that just an American thing? Absolutely not. A lot of my friends grew up the opposite. Every time they had a dream, their parents would poke holes in it and talk about how, oh, what about this? You'll never have enough money for that. Oh, but it's so difficult to do that. Oh, but you won't be tall enough. Oh, but what? All the reasons why not. I am so thankful my parents never thought about why not. All they ever did was cheer on our potential. Some of you grew up like I did. Some of you grew up on the other end of that. Or all you ever heard was all the reasons why you can't be what you were dreaming you could be. You know, let's not be that way. Let's be like Moses' parents. Let's look at the next generation, whether they're in our own house, our own kids, whether they're in kids' church or around. Let's look and let's see. This is not ordinary. This is something special. And you know what? Like that old Jaguar, with a little bit of restoration, with a little bit of work, with a little bit of investment. Wow. What they could become. It's amazing. That's how his parents were. Secondly, what you need, and I'm going to rush through this now. In order to raise a Moses generation, number one, you need vision. You need to see correctly. Number two, you need faith. And what does the scripture tell us? Verse 23, by faith, Moses' parents hid him. At the end of that verse, it says they were not afraid of the king's edict. It's a choice, folks. You either move in faith or you move in fear. You don't move in both at the same time. And I watch a lot of parents and a lot of youth pastors and a lot of kids pastors and a lot of pastors and a lot of people who are trying to minister to the next generation. And they're just all afraid of all the evil out there. And they're afraid of what will happen instead of moving in faith for what God could make happen. We've got to be people of faith and always believing. In our church in Nashville a couple of months ago, there's a single lady who's a single mom raising a couple of teenagers. And the single mom saw me with my grown children, and came in, and she was a new believer, and she said, I don't know what to do as a single mom with my teenage boy. She looked at me and she said, how did you raise three boys? Here was my answer. I said, I got a lot of help. A lot of help. She goes, what do you mean? I started talking about our kids pastor when they were little, Pastor Paulo Punzalan. What he put in my kids in kids church. A love for the Bible.
Wow, they got that from Pastor Paulo. And then Rico, the guy on the screen a minute ago at his wedding, he was our youth pastor. He's now one of the pastors at Ortigas, one of the lead pastors. But he was a youth pastor then when my kids were younger. And what he put him, Dan, I don't know if Dan's here right now. I think maybe it's the next service. But Dan was in a discipleship group with my sons and with Rico when Dan was a teenager. And Rico said, our youth pastor, our kids pastor, we didn't have any family here. Okay, we're foreigners here. Raising my family here away from family. But you know what? We had people who became like family and treated us like family. For 12 years, our next door neighbors, the Bonifacios, Joey and Marie, they treated my family like their family. They helped raise my kids. And I told this lady, I said, we had a lot of help. What you see in my sons is not just because I'm such a great dad. It's because we were smart enough to get all the help we could get. And that's what the church community is. It's a place, not where we're going to raise your kids for you, but there's sure a lot of help available. That's what this is about. And she was so happy to see that, and people are starting to help this single mom fill in the gaps with her kids, because that's what the community's about, the team. So what do you need to raise a Moses generation? You need vision. You need faith. And number three, protection. It says Moses' parents hid him for 3 months. There was a demonically inspired scheme to kill these kids. And Moses' parents protected Moses. And folks, we have to protect the next generation from the pharaohs that are out there trying to kill them. A lot of pharaohs out there. A lot of demonically inspired schemes to kill off the next generation before they can reach the greatness God's called them to. One of the first ones that's after this generation is abortion. I know abortion is illegal in the Philippines, but it happens all the time. Thousands upon thousands of kids are slaughtered before they get to breathe their first breath. What else is out there? Child trafficking. Of the hundreds of thousands into the millions of children being trafficked as sex slaves around the world. Get this. Listen to this. This is not a pretty picture. It's heartbreaking. But of all of the millions out there being trafficked now of children, one out of every 10 is a Filipino. One out of 10. Right here in our backyard. Trying to kill this next generation. What else is out there? Pornography. It's wiping out a generation. This is a generation of screenagers. They've always got a screen in front of their face. But pornography doesn't just go after the young ones. The old ones too. I'll give you a practical tip here. To protect your family. Here's how we protect our staff. Go to this website, xxxchurch.com. When you get home, if you have screenagers in your family, I would encourage you, plead with you to go to xxxchurch.com and click on the yellow button that says 3X Pure. Here's what that'll do. It'll download software into your computer. And in that software, it's a free download. It'll protect your family from pornography, not by filtering it. Here's what it does. All of our staff, everybody on staff with this church, doesn't matter how old they are, male or female, married or single, they all have to do this. It's a policy. It's in everybody's computer. And here's what it'll do. You download the software and up pops a window and you have to put 3 email addresses in there. And mine, it's my wife, my pastor, Sam Webb, and I send it to myself because I wanted to understand how the system worked. And here's what happens. Everybody, if you click on something questionable, immediately it sends an email report to those people who you just put your email. And here's the best part about it. If you ever turn it off, it sends a report to those people saying, so-and-so just turned it off. With a date and the time and how long it was off. You can't escape. How many of you think if your mother or your wife or your pastor got a report of what you clicked on, it might change your clicking habits? One time, Pastor June Escosar, has June ever preached here? When June got the software in his computer a couple of years ago, because all of our staff has it, because we are serious about protecting our team and our kids from the poison that's out there. June got it on his software. Pastor Luther Mankow. Luther preached here before? Yep. Luther was his accountability. And Luther got a report at midnight one night. about something June had searched on Google. Now, June was training for a triathlon. That's when you run, you bike, and you swim. June was a good runner and a good biker, but a really slow swimmer. And so he was trying a new, instead of the normal swimming, he was trying the breaststroke. And he had Googled breaststroke videos. And it alarmed the system that, I guess, the combination of those names, and it sent out to Luther that June has Googled breast. So Luther's going, oh no, of all the people, I would have never suspected June. And then they, you know, it gives you what they clicked. And Luther was afraid to click it. So he called June. And June goes, what? No, breaststroke, click it. And it was how to do breaststroke faster. Because June was coming in last in the triathlon. But some of you need that. If you have screenagers in your family, or if you have problems with what you're looking at on your screens, whether you're young or old, that'll change your habits right there. And it's free. All right. Just a commercial from our sponsor, triplelegchurch.com. You know what else is out there killing the next generation? You know another pharaoh that's out there? It's called materialism. I've watched, in the 27 years I've been in your country, I've watched prosperity happen. I've watched a middle class begin emerging. I've watched people whose families had never owned an automobile, and suddenly people are getting educated and they're buying cars. They'd never, you know, owned a home. They've lived in tiny cramped quarters, and now they're getting this. They're getting homes. I've watched this, but I've watched it choke out spiritual passion at the same time. Materialism is a killer. It really is. It's dangerous. So here's the deal. If we're going to raise a Moses generation that knows how to refuse and knows how to choose, then we're going to have to be people of vision, of faith, with some protection set in our world. Some people way overprotect. They treat their 18-year-olds like they're 8. And some people underprotect. They just are irresponsible and anything goes. Somewhere in the middle is sanity. And that's what we need to find.